What is happening? Welcome to another episode of The Craft. My name is Nick Pollock, and oh my gosh, look at this. It's Eno Saris as a guest today. Eno, so good to see you once again.
What a surprise.
Speaking of surprises, it's funny that you say that. Because if you watched baseball last night, that is Tuesday night, my gosh, there were so many ridiculous performances. I mean, just across the board. I do generally for fantasy side, I say, cool, here are the general rankings of what we should expect this on this day of performance. And the entire bottom half were exceptional. And I kind of want to take this podcast to talk about some of these names because some of them are just, what is this? So is this real? Is it not?
So you're not talking about dominating Zach Wheeler start.
No.
Everyone saw coming.
That's my SP1 right there. And actually, funny enough, Wheeler didn't even have the best four-seamer command that he has normally in that one, which is kind of nuts. It was like lower fastballs and not really the high stuff that we see. But yeah, don't bait me.
I wonder sometimes if things like that are like matchup, you know, because sure, there are a fair amount of high ball hitters on the Giants. So some of those guys have flat swings. I know that like Flores and Tyro Estrada in particular are high ball hitters.
That might be it. And also because the low vert for Wheeler might actually be able to then turn those into grounders if they're down against that flat swing.
I mean, for whatever it was, like, he definitely was dominating them.
Oh my gosh, it was so good. But no more Wheeler. No, that's not the point of this. Okay. And actually, I mentioned somebody. I did, I'm doing these YouTube breakdowns now. I did two of them from last night in today's video. Go check that out at youtube.com/pitcherlist. And you said that one of these guys was already one of your names, so I wanted you to take the lead here about Matt Waldron.
Yeah. So this didn't necessarily happen last night because I guess he's done this once before. But Matt Waldron is now the undisputed king of knuckleball velocity.
100%.
He has two knuckleballs that have gone faster than any one that R.A. Dickey threw. And I did this extensive pair of interviews with R.A. Dickey. That was actually one of my first moments in the clubhouse doing an interview like that, is before I was credentialed with the Baseball Writers Association. And we talked a little bit about velocity, and he admitted that it was important to him. And, you know, so when he was Cy Dickey, he had his best knuckleball velocity of his career.
Right.
And it seems so weird to talk about such an unconventional pitch in these weird terms. But, you know, fastball velocity still matters for knuckleballers.
Oh, yeah.
I checked out. We have 36,000 plus knuckleballs in the pitch tracking era. You know, that sounds like a lot, but it's like three or four guys.
Yeah, sure.
But it's still a lot of knuckleballs. And I looked at knuckleballs over 80. They produce a 190 batting average and a 292 slugging percentage. And knuckleballs under 80 produce a 255 batting average and a 417 slugging percentage.
Oh, man.
The whiff rate goes from 24 to 22, too. So basically, they're better. And what's interesting to me about this is that the knuckleball is actually more conventional than people want to give it credit for. Here's one example. Velocity matters just like any other one, right? And I was looking at the 84-mile-an-hour knuckleball that Matt Waldron threw in his last start, I believe. Was it yesterday? No, yeah. He threw an 83 yesterday. I don't know.
Oh, I don't know when the peak went. I think it was 80-ish yesterday, not the peak 83.
Yeah, but anyway, I looked at the 84, which came last year in June, and it just looked like a back foot slider. It does not look like your traditional.
It actually was yesterday for Waldron. He did throw 84 at max. That was to Jazz Chisholm in the fifth inning swing strike.
Oh, okay. Yes, I see that one. Let me look at it real quick.
Yeah, me too. I'm going to speed run. Let's see who can find it first.
We're watching it right now. Yeah, dude, that looks like a changeup.
Mm.
So this is like an annoying point of nuance that I'm never going to try and draw publicly on Twitter or anywhere, sure. Like, because it's,
but only here.
Here, well, this is the craft. This is the nuance podcast. So it's something that Alan Nathan proved, and at its essence, you're like, duh, but it's actually kind of interesting. So on any given knuckleball, they act like conventional pitches.
Mm-hmm.
The brilliance of the knuckleball is that you have no idea which conventional pitch it will be.
Right.
So when I looked at the other 84 mile an hour pitch that I have that I saw in the database, it looked like a back foot slider. It just dove into the ground, into the back foot. And then we looked at another 84 mile an hour knuckleball thrown the same way, both to left-handed hitters. He has, so there's the detriment of not knowing which one it's going to be.
Sure. Yeah.
But what's interesting to me is this. We want pitchers to kind of be random pitch generators.
Yeah. Yeah.
Generally.
Yeah.
Like we talk about, oh, I hope this pitcher, you know, I want this pitcher to add another pitch. I want this pitcher to even out. So he's 30-30-30 in every count, or 25-25-25 in every count. So the hitter can't ever anticipate and figure out what's coming and put the right swing on the right pitch, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's why the knuckleball is brilliant. It's not, people sort of ogle at some of these moving images and say, and I say moving images because apparently I say the word GIF wrong, and I'm just not.
You do. If you guys don't know, PitcherList is actually Pitcher GIFs Inc. And it's a part of the contract that everyone signs that you have to pronounce.
Okay. GIF. So moving images it is. You know, like when you see these moving images, sometimes it feels like the knuckleball is doing things that are impossible. And there is some debate about whether or not it can actually like go right and then go left.
Mm.
And I think that's impossible. It's physically impossible.
I don't know.
The way that air moves over a ball and the way that the ball is catching, I think it's physically impossible to go in two directions.
I've seen these moving images though.
I know. That's what I say. So this is why I don't try to do it on Twitter, because, you know,
it's bonkers.
How many times
thinking about that one R.A. Dickey GIF? You know the one?
Yeah.
That's
definitely the one that I'm thinking of. And I think it's a trick of the camera angle. Think about it this way. How many times have you looked up a pitch that said like, oh, like you've done like best of year lists or whatever, and it's like,
sure, yeah,
the moviest pitch of the year, like this one had the biggest X on the year, and then you look at the video of it and you're like, that doesn't
camera angles, man,
right?
Oh, so God. Like I've been having a war against camera angles for a long time. I'm so, thank you so much, Milwaukee, for yours, because that Ben Brown video was so much better.
But in any case, like, so Waldron at 84 miles an hour is it's like, I think 84 is also an important number if you think about it with sliders.
Mm. Yeah.
So, you know, 85 is a really important number for sliders. So if you can get to 84, if you throw a knuckleball that turns into a slider, then it's a better one at 84.
Right.
Right. Right? And if you throw an 84 mile an hour power changeup, that's better than if you threw it 79, you know? Sure.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
It is weird to think of so normally about a weird pitcher,
mm-hmm.
but if he's going to average 80 plus on his knuckleball, then I think he is going to be much more than an innings eater. That's the difference between Tim Wakefield and R.A. Dickey.
Yeah, sure.
Is pretty that. Much that is yeah. velo.
Oh man. So it's funny, cause I think I've mentioned this before and here, maybe I haven't. The first pitcherless shirt that I ever made was "Don't trust a knuckleballer." it's a graphic of a pitcher in the windup wearing a bandana, and it's because essentially you just don't know if it's going to be there or not. Mm-hmm. That's what it is. It's like, especially this was the days of like Steven Wright, where I just don't know, is it going to be there, is it not? And to think that like Waldron for three straight games has done this, I mean, it has been really good against the Dodgers, against Atlanta, against the Marlins. I say knuckleballers are more a potent agnostic, because if it's working, then like they're not used to it. This isn't what they're trained at, right? So I'm with you, and I like the idea of the random number generator and everything like that is what you want them to be. You're absolutely right in the sense of you don't want it to be the random number generator in a bad place, right? You don't want it to be the, like, if I'm saying, cool, I'm going to throw a four seamer, it's going to be between four seamer, slider, and changeup, let's just say. You don't want that to be in the middle of the plate, regardless of what that is. That's still going to be bad. And that's kind of the difference, I think, between a lot of the good ones and the bad ones we've seen from Waldron. The old phrase is, if it's high, let it fly. If it's low, let it go. Waldron isn't floating these. Mm-hmm. I didn't see yesterday against the Marlins many of these that actually just floated in the upper third of the zone. And I think that's the biggest flaw that we normally see with knuckleballs. You don't get strikes. And when you do, if you're getting a lot of strikes, that means generally that means they're floating into the zone or something like that. Waldron's keeping it down. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, I did a query on the harder ones.
Yeah,
expecting to find them in the dirt, because some of the ones you'll look at are in the dirt. And I found that Waldron's 80 plus mile an hour knuckleballers are in the if you include the shadow mm-hmm. heart and you know, just the zone, 88% of the time.
Look at that.
So, you know, I had this thing, you know, from my old interview with R.A. Dickey, that he used his lower movement, harder knuckleballs in hitter friendly counts, you know, because he thought mm-hmm. it was easier to throw strikes. Well, listen, if you are throwing your harder knuckleballs in the shadow or closer 88% of the time.
Yeah.
And they're better pitches.
Yeah.
And they function better. Then you should just throw the hard one all the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
But knuckleballers, it's hard to reason with them.
Don't trust them. Don't trust them. It's really fun to watch this. And I think there's an idea that because they keep saying don't trust a knuckleballer, like you can't trust it. No. It's insane, the stuff that he does. The last pitch of the first inning, did you catch that one? It was this 83 mile per hour knuckler that looked like the nastiest splitter you've ever seen. I mean, it was, watch the last pitch of the first inning. It is absolutely bonkers. And what's even funnier to me is that the previous at bat was to Josh Bell, where he threw this first pitch, one that looked like a curve almost at 79 inside. And then he threw two sinkers in a row. It was an 0-1 sinker upstairs to Josh Bell that he fouled off at 90. And it's kind of cool that Waldron can be like, yo, what's up? Here's 90. And that's really fun. Actually, I have some concern about, like, should be a sinker instead of a four-seamer?
Jesus Sanchez?
I believe that was Sanchez. Lefty, right? Number four batter for the Marlins. But it was so filthy.
Oh, God dang.
If you want to see that video, just go check out the Ben Brown breakdown. I had Matt Waldron as my bonus pitcher.
Oh my
and
god,
the last pitch of that entire thing, it's like the filthiest. I remember watching this yesterday and just going, man, it was the moment that I missed the days of where I used to be the first one out with nasty pitches. Right? If you guys don't know this, the history of Pitcher List, I started off doing the whole Pitcher Ninja thing in 2014, like being that guy. You found me in the first place or something. I feel like I replied to a tweet with you, like, here's the gif of it.
Yeah.
And it used to be a fun thing. Like at night, I would just stay home and just gif everything as fast as possible. And then I kind of got out of that game.
Because it's exhausting. I can't believe Pitching Ninja does it still.
Oh, it's incredible. I mean, it's one of those things of like, then Pitching Ninja swooped in and was doing so well. And I was like, cool. I don't feel like I need to be that because he's doing it.
It's crazy because I used to be the grips guy, right? And now I don't even know if I should bother. I mean, I still do it from time to time, but
the thing is, it's like for me, it was just we need to get people to appreciate nasty pitches. Yeah. And if that happens, then that means enthusiasm for being a pitcher is there, which means great, I can talk about the thing I want to more people who care about it, right? Mm-hmm. So I cannot be happier with Pitching Ninja when he's on. Also, Rob's a great guy. Which is always just makes things better. But that pitch, oh my gosh, that Matt Waldron knuckler, oh, it is so nice at the end of the first inning. Go watch that one. But just to finish the point about kind of like how Waldron goes about this, it is a sinker, a 90, that he does actually go upstairs with. And there's these two pitches before that at bat to Sanchez. They throws to Josh Bell at 0-1, fouls off at 90. And all you think is like, okay, this is a sinker that you're supposed to sneak by. It should be like, oh no, it should be either a whiff or a called strike. If they make contact,
that was what R.A. Dickey did. Like he threw an 80 poo
right.
fastball that
but
he
this
was
90 even, right? Like,
yeah.
And the fact that Josh Bell fouls that off,
Waldron has a working
that we don't really
UCL.
Talk about a ton is sequencing on this. And we haven't done that a lot, but I think I sent you my secret guide to sequencing. I don't know if you ever read that or not. I made this whole thing last October.
I read that.
I was just so fed up watching the playoffs. And I was like, it's right there. This is the book. Let me just write the book, you know, and I did it. And maybe one day I'll share it with people as I kind of like make it look a little bit more professional. One of the things in the book is like, look, if you throw a high fastball that's out of the zone at 0-1 and they make contact on it, you don't throw that again. Like that is them saying like, hey, I'm looking for this and I'm almost on it. And yes, you'll get the swing out of the zone, but like they might actually do something on it.
That reminds
me. You have to throw something slower or
Devers
high level
last
or whatever.
Week.
And he did it. Waldron like threw another force, a fastball at 0-2, two in a row. And what happened? Bell got a double down the line. I'm like,
and you have the knuckleball at your disposal, dude.
You threw it like six times this entire game. I mean, threw two in that first inning. I was like, oh, maybe not anymore. But like, oh my gosh, it drove me up the wall. There's something to be said about that. And also, Matt Waldron doesn't really know in the first inning, do I have this? Do I have the knuckleball working? Do I have all this other stuff? You know? So you are figuring it out. That's why I think always the first innings are such a weird moment. Like Zach Allen, I remember talking to him. His mentality has been, hey, I'm throwing everything in the first inning because I have to think like a closing in the first inning. I need to make sure that I get through that because it's always going to be the most chaotic one. Of me not really knowing what I'm
which
feeling.
Which is the opposite of old school, which was 100%. Only show your fastball, establish the fastball. Don't let him see that stuff. It is interesting. I think that because Gallen has a wide enough arsenal, he's okay. But if you were like a two or three pitch pitcher, even like if you showed all three of your pitches early, like what we do know about the third time through the order penalty is to some degree, it's about getting familiar with shapes.
Sure.
So there is something about hiding some shapes. With the knuckleballer though, you don't,
doesn't matter. It's random.
Shapes. They're all the shapes. It's a random shape generator.
It is so, the most rainbow of pitches.
If I was him, I would start throwing a ton of knuckleballs in the first inning just to make sure I had it.
Yeah.
And then I would pitch backwards off the knuckleball because it's probably your best pitch. And then I'd be careful about when I threw that fastball because it's not a good fastball.
It's not. And I do wonder, it should be a four seamer because like the sinker. Like you want to stay up as much as you can, even though it's not like a
to
good
look more like when you're high knucklers or something.
Yeah. Because
here's
like
the other thing though, aren't the mechanics so different on the knuckleball that you're not really.
Oh, you're not hiding it as much.
Yeah. You can't be like, oh, this came out of the same slot or something.
Because well,
you
yes and no.
Shot put it. It's not, it's like a whole different thing.
Yeah.
You have to be like you. What I think is you have to establish yourself as the shot putter. And then when you go into like a full windup and do like a full fastball, like they're going to probably the instinct is probably going to be to take because they're sitting knuckler.
Yeah. I've actually hit against knuckleballs before.
Yeah.
And it's not that easy. I mean, yeah. I'm sure these are like major leaguers. So they'll tell me
it might be harder for them because it's at a different velo than they're normally sitting.
Like, right.
When's the last time they sat 80 on somebody?
Yeah. I mean, there's also the theory of like you go against a knuckleballer, what do? You get up in the box. Anytime you have massive movement, guys, Ryan Yarbrough, you're supposed to get up in the box.
Yeah.
It's just what you do. You say, hey, wait, I have an advantage because you throw slower. I want to take advantage of that. No. That means that you're giving the ball more time to move away from your barrel. Mm. You limit that. You get out in front of it and you take the, you know, instead of 89, you make it 92 or whatever you want to say it is. But you do that because now you can hit it a lot better and it's more what you're used to. That's the tradition, what you do. There is actually two guys. It's a good transition from there. It's and we're going to talk about
one last thing. One last thing on Waldron.
Yes.
If you're looking for something actionable, if you're someone who listens because you bet or you do DFS or whatever. And I just wanted to connect a line of thought
with
you that wasn't. You started it, but
I started.
if you're watching a Waldron start, there are places that offer in-game props mm-hmm. and in-game betting and stuff like that. And I know you don't like to talk about this, but I
sure
think
don't.
One thing that's kind of interesting about it is if you see Waldron throwing 80 mile an hour plus knuckleballs in the first inning, it's probably going to be a good start.
Yeah, right.
We can talk about it in those terms if you'd like.
Yeah. Yeah. I still hate it. Guys, I will not ever endorse.
Well, anyway, I'm just saying he should establish it. He should throw it hard in the first inning and work off of that back.
Right. You can probably, what you're saying is that Waldron, it's one of those times where like, okay, cool. This guy's cooking.
That's what I'm saying. And I think that like he does have the potential to be one of the, maybe the best knuckleball of the modern era. Like if you think about it, if he could throw it consistently over 80, he has other pitches that Ari Dickey never had.
I mean, obviously, of course, it's always like the thing about Ari Dickey is that he was great, but it was over time. And, you know, we're really, I think, truly like three starts into seeing that potential with Waldron.
Yeah.
Hopefully that can stick around.
I mean, he's striking out way more guys than Dickey ever did.
Sure. It's also a higher striker rate across the league more.
Across the league, yeah.
But give me the plus on that. Anyway, we got a lot of other guys to talk about from last night. Two interesting transitions from what we were just talking about. We're going to talk about those guys after this break. So, okay. You know, the first one is you're talking about sequencing and like, what do you show in the first inning, right? Mm-hmm. And Ben Brown, my gosh. Seven innings, 0 runs, 0 hits, 10 Ks, 2 walks against the Brewers. Obviously, the right call, 93 pitches. You can't throw this rookie who isn't really stretched out anyway as a starter. I actually didn't think he was going to go very long in this one. And I was like, yeah, don't start this because like he's going to go 4 innings, like 60 plus pitches. And, you know, he doesn't generally have the best command. And what is he
doing? I didn't rank him high enough because when my rankings last came out, he was still in the bullpen. It was like right as all that stuff was happening.
Right, right.
I pushed him today into the 60s.
So I want to talk more about Ben Brown here. And what's interesting is watching that first inning was your old school approach. The first 10 pitches that Ben Brown threw were all four seamers.
Mm.
The only curveball he threw was the very last one, which was this absolute hammer of an 88 mile per hour curve down and into Christian Yelich when he was just completely sitting fastball. It's one of those beautiful swings on a curve where are just completely selling out for a fastball. So it's just, oh, cool. Like a 2 foot difference between. You know,
I mean, he can't be Gallen. He has 2 pitches.
Well, that's the thing.
Yeah.
Right. Is you can't really showcase all of it in the first season necessarily because all you have is the curve. However, what's so interesting about Ben Brown for me is I don't know how much I love his 2 pitches overall. The curve yesterday had 10 whiffs over 32 thrown, which is just bonkers. It was the best version of the curve I've seen. The most consistent down that I've seen. The four seamer. 6 whiffs on 61 thrown, where he had 17 called strikes. 17 on that pitch. The Brewers were super passive with it. Actually, the one time when they should have been passive was the third pitch of the game. Bryce Turang got the 2-0 to start a game, by the way. I'm going to say this really quickly, guys. To start a baseball game, if you go 2-0 on a batter, you essentially are telling them, hey, I'm throwing a fastball now. To start a game, you don't want to get a 3-0 on the first batter of the game, okay?
And it was outside the zone, and Turang.
And here's the thing, right? So Bryce Turang, hey, what's up? Okay, cool. I'm batting over 300. I know pitching. I know what they do. It's going to be a fastball, okay? And by the way, I'm like acting as if I'm swinging right now. Would you guys get
that?
Okay? Yeah. So and as a lefty, I'm a righty, and you get that kind of thing at 2-0. Not only is it going to be a fastball, I'm only going to be swinging at the one I want to hit, right? And I just caught my green screen. Okay. I'm so happy I'm standing.
I mean, I'm looking at matchups tool on Savant.
Yeah.
It looks like it was about 4 inches out of the zone away.
So that's the thing. It was not a strike. It wasn't this pitch to Bryce Turang at 2-0 started maybe on the outside edge, like perfectly spotted, which is not the pitch you swing at 2-0 to start a game.
Right.
And then he went away out of the zone and he swung and missed. And it's like,
because you would get more information by letting it go and seeing what the umpire is going to call that day. I mean, that's as much more valuable than.
And that's not good contact for you.
Yeah, that's not going to be a good pitch.
Right. So this is such an important swing in this entire game to me, because that was the moment that Ben Brown could have lost that one.
Mm-hmm.
He could have lost his confidence, could have 3-0 now. Maybe there's a fastball down the middle now that actually he takes and swings. Maybe he misses it, 4-pitch walk. Like, he's not feeling good now. Mm-hmm. But because that's the first at bat where he swings and misses on that one, he's like, great, cool, I'm going to throw another fastball in there. Terrain takes it. It's in the zone. Strike two. Throws another fastball to the bottom of the zone. Strike three, called strike. Like, that, and there it is. All of a sudden, Ben Brown going from like, oh no, this is a disaster, to, oh no, my fastball's amazing, I feel great. And there's your ball game, kind of, right? So what I see overall from Ben Brown is this fastball doesn't have like elite shape. It has great velocity. And it's fine. It's like, it's fine across the board. And then you have a curveball that was as good as possible yesterday. And I actually remember talking to Tyone about this and being like, I kind of see you a bit here, Tyone and Ben Brown, where when you first came up, you were fastball curve and you didn't have that third option. You were trying to mess around with the changeup. Didn't really have that. Eventually you got the slider going. And Tyone was like, yeah, I'm, you know, kind of working with him a bit. He saw him a little bit like that, as we see him as like that just exceptional reliever. Sometimes hopefully getting a start and falling into that, into it. I feel like yesterday for Ben Brown was this, and you know, you want to know what the comp is? Actually, I'm curious. Do you have like a comp for Ben Brown of a pitcher who was a reliever and then turned into a starter for a bit the last like 4 years? Can you get it? 2-pitch fastball breaker, mid to upper 90s fastball.
I know it should be obvious.
Not the greatest command. Sometimes would be amazing. Sometimes would be terrible. Also in Chicago.
What?
Other side of town.
Oh, other side of town. Cease?
Kopech.
Oh, Kopech.
Right? Ooh, I mean, Kopech had a more overwhelming
Kopech's command is like bottom shelf.
Sure. But his there were games where it was
better than Brown's.
There are games that it wasn't.
Yeah.
Right. And those games were ridiculous. It was like, oh my gosh, it's five innings of 10 strikeouts. This is great. I think the Ben Brown
also, like, he has more vert and more, yeah, just, yeah, more movement. And,
right.
But here, I'm trying to find a comp for Ben Brown's fastball. It's really, really close to Scooble's, which most people think is not great shape.
Yeah, I don't. No, and he's not getting a lot of whiffs on it this year either. He's helping out with the sinker mostly.
It's kind of close to Kikuchi's.
No,
it kind of is. Ben Brown's. It's okay. So, like, I guess an inch of vert is worth more than.
Well, I mean, the
I'm trying to match it on the horizontal.
The low release is unreal with Kikuchi.
Oh yeah, vert release 5.4. Ben Brown 6.2. Yeah, that's important. So. Yeah, I mean, Scooble's actually the best one, because if you're trying to get that like, he has a little bit more horizontal than some of the people around him.
Yeah.
It's a little bit similar to Crochet's, actually.
Crochet has more extension, I think.
Yep.
And that's what, I mean, so I talk about this a lot. We have this really cool tool for PL Pro members called Today's Four Seamers. Mm-hmm. And you have PL Pro, so I can make sure that you have it in front of you. But what we do with this one is we highlight the Fantastic Four, which is what I call the four elements that gets fans batters. It's inside the private chat there, you know. And the what's really fun about it is it says, cool, here's velocity, here's extension, here's induced vertical break, and it has height-adjusted VAA, which I personally like to use more than VAA. Because VAA is about where you locate it. And height adjusted VAA is pretty much just saying that is regardless of where you locate it, essentially assuming it's down the middle. And one is kind of like the average of it. Mm-hmm. So under one is steeper and above one is flatter. So I can
Ben Brown looks great by fan four.
Right. So because it likes fan four of like the velocity. Fan four just loves velocity. So like it's a 97 mile per hour four seamer yesterday. But the extension is under 7. It's good. Mm-hmm. 6.8, but it's not. The vert is right at 16, which is good, but not elite. And his height adjusted VA is 1. So, I mean, it's a case where the velocity is able to live and not be affected negatively, which is why Fan 4 loves it. It essentially says just whiff rate chance. As you see, all those guys in that first column are like velocity guys. But then you see like someone else who did really well yesterday.
Yes. And he was on my bench in the main event. I'm so mad.
Well, I mean, it's the Dodgers.
I know. Okay. Yeah.
But this is I think this is a very interesting conversation because I talk about this stuff a lot And I talk about this with Kyle a ton. Kyle Bland, our director of stats analytics here at PitcherList, who creates all these incredible things with PLV. And I'm trying to figure out just internally how much weight I should be giving to Vert. Because the models are pretty much just saying like Vert is king.
Yeah.
And what I have seen, though, are guys like Zach Wheeler, who break that model, because his vert is like 13 to 14. But because he has elite extension, it's 7.4, which is insane. And then you have a 1.6 height adjusted VAA, which is absurdly flat. With that 96, all of a sudden, that is just as good as the 97 and the 16 inches of vert that Ben Brown has, right? So balancing all those things is interesting to me. I'm kind of curious what your take is on really those four elements of pitch shape and what you really mean when you say pitch shape and what matters to you.
Yeah, I'm trying to move beyond just IVB. I think that was my first sort of love affair.
Yeah, right.
You know, of course. And I remember going on Brooks Baseball and saying, oh my gosh, it has more than 9 inches vert,
right?
In their style, you know.
Yep.
And I circled anybody who did that, and you know, then maybe the very first love affair was velo. So and you can't look away from that. Extension has become interesting to me ever since I realized that the Rays really love it, and they basically lead the league in extension every year. And I knew that it was important in my model, but I would say that it's probably secondary importance to IVB and velo. So I guess I would rank it third. I'd probably rank it velo, IVB, extension. But there are guys that, like sort of Zach Wheeler, that, you know, and also I would have to point out that Zach Wheeler's velo has been going up start by start. And
yeah,
you know,
I mean, he traditionally does slow down a little bit, I think, early in the year and then ramp up.
Yeah,
he does that a bit. We've seen in previous years. I think also with like the shoulder injury, he had like two years ago. And then that's just kind of been like, you know what? I'm just going to do this all the time.
Why did Freddie Peralta only have a 6.5 extension yesterday? I thought he was the king of extension.
I know. I saw that too. And I thought that was very, very interesting. He's the king of vert too.
It wasn't a great IVB game either.
Yeah. So I don't know if there's something about that. I mean, I would actually imagine at times those are linked. Just because,
but you didn't even say the guy's name. We're talking about Tyler McGill, right?
Yeah, Tyler McGill is the one that we want.
Even though I would have extension probably third, I think what has changed for me is that the distance between them has changed.
Yeah,
you know, I think it used to think, oh, it's velo is king, and then when I figured out IVB, I was like, well, velo is still king, but IVB is the second most important. And now I'm sort of like, you know, you can kind of, if you're dominant in two out of the three, you can be good. And that is actually, I think, at its core, what is so difficult for me about Stuff Plus and modern pitching analysis is that there are so many different ways to be good. And we know that.
Right.
That it's hard to have hard and fast rules where you say, look for this, circle this, look for this, circle this, you know, because if you're right, you look at this thing and you say, well, Zach Wheeler had, you know, the fifth best velocity of the day among the starters, the third best extension, the worst IVB on the day.
Yeah, pretty. I mean, some others had bad, but I mean, it's still, yeah, not good IVB.
Yeah, like not like blue, at least blue IVB. You know? Like it's kind of like, you know, if you're just working with a fantastic three, you'd say, you know, he was the, you know, just eyeballing, I'd say like, oh, he'd be the fourth best start of the day, but like he was not.
Is that when the torch gave up and like leaves in the middle of the movie? It's a Fantastic Four.
Oh,
so that's the Fan Four.
We're just looking at the three. yeah, height adjusted VAA. I think what's the only thing that's holding me back right now is that I'm a little bit in the space where like there's three different places to find it, three different numbers, three different conventions, and I'm like, yep. I just need to pick one, I guess.
Yeah, pick ours. It's good.
Stuff Plus does love that, and basically what you're showing in Hava, which is just really just top shelf.
I know. I just want to call it attack angle, personally.
Yeah, except that you then there's a batting attack angle.
Shh. You want pa? Is that what you want?
Pa.
You want another pitching plus AA? Is that what you want?
Well, you know what that is? It's release point.
Yeah. Well, no, right. It's saying how low are you getting also? And like, you know, so physically, yeah, like the, you know, the tilt of it, and also just physically, are your legs lower, you know? Which I think is so interesting about it. And it's why, like, Imanaga.
Well, you can also just be short.
Yeah. And it's actually, I remember hearing interviews about this, like guys wishing that they were short all of a sudden. Yeah. Like, I'm 6'4". And people say, oh, you should play basketball. It's like, well, no. I mean, it's really helpful to be lengthy and have a good extension for.
Well, I used to ogle all the tall starters in the draft.
But then, you know, I'm happy that like Tyler McGill and Glasnow have this great extension, but they aren't getting as low as you want. I mean, Tyler McGill is kind of figuring it out a bit.
Well, there's also an interesting aspect here. So if you look at McGill's line, you're like, okay, extension is the best foot forward. That's the reddest red, right?
Yeah.
His IVB is around 15. That's boring.
Yeah.
But given his mechanics, his attack angle is decent.
Mm-hmm.
If he didn't throw 95.8 yesterday, he wouldn't have been in the top four.
Yeah.
And the weirdest thing for me when I'm looking over his last year plus of starts is just how dang erratic his velocity has been. Starts ago, he was, what was it here? 94.8 before going 95.9.
Mm-hmm.
And he was 94.7 in his first start of the year. Last year, he was down to 94.2. You know, he was living in the 94s to begin last year. So, you know, I like him a lot more at 95. And it just makes me nervous, man. It's like, is that like injury coming? Like, why does he have, if you look at his start to start velo, there's just these huge troughs.
What a good word.
He goes down like a mile and a half and just sits 94 something, which is where he sat for a large part of last year, and he wasn't as good.
Right.
So I think that he's got a little bit of what I call the fragile fastball, which is it depends a lot more on velo than you want.
I'm with you there. I see a little bit of the Bailey Ober potential in Tyler McGill. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit after this break. So the Bailey Ober potential is you have a lot of extension, and as long as you can paint the top of the zone red with that extension, especially at this velocity, like, you are going to do well. This was better overall a PLV location plus for that fastball this time around. And honestly, like, I'm really surprised at the 1.2 attack angle for McGill's four-seamer, because that actually helps it, you know, just a little bit more upstairs. Not like the biggest one. 1.2 is above average, but it's not like a 1.4, 1.5 kind of thing. And I love seeing McGill do that and then be able to throw any sort of secondary underneath it for strikes. What happened yesterday, and this was against the Dodgers, keep in mind. Like, it wasn't just the Mariners or something, or the Tigers, where you say, hey, here's a fastball. What am I supposed to do with this? And, you know, the Dodgers actually struggle a bit against Mika. Like, even seeing Mookie Betts whiff on a four-seamer, it's like, whoa, this is fun. It's really important that McGill has the secondaries to complement it. And the thing that gets overlooked, I think, with Bailey Ober, for example, is that I do focus on the, hey, cool, paint the top of the zone red, but it's an elite changeup off of that. And it's really hard with his extension to figure those two out. And then even adding the cutter/slider this year for McGill, for McGill Ober, is just giving him another direction to look, another place to look for hitters that is really allowing him to be that consistent floor guy. I think that McGill has enough in there to do that. The slider and cutter are not bad. They need to be a little bit more precise. But him throwing them upstairs and even middle yesterday with the four-seamers really diluted the waters, I think, for the Dodgers. And then you have the American Spork, which is just not good. Like, I want it to happen. I understand the whole ghost fork with Kodai. And then it's, hey, cool, American Spork. But it's just not consistent. So you're absolutely right about velocity, because it, you know, that margin of error is even, it's larger, of course, with that velocity. I think it also has to deal with, look, I would take a 94 mile per hour Tyler McGill. So sorry. If it were always upstairs like that. Thing is, it's not.
Get the most out of his attack angle or whatever.
Exactly. So I hope to see that from McGill moving forward. Anything else you want to mention on McGill? Because I had a perfect segue to another guy.
Well, one last thing I want to do is expound a little bit on this fragile fastball idea, looking at this.
Oh, yeah.
Looking at this list. And I know this isn't a complete list. It's just yesterday's starters.
Yeah.
But I like the color coding because it's giving me a chance to maybe formulate an idea for what could be a fragile fastball. So Kevin Gausman has a light color around 94.3 is around average.
Yeah.
But good extension, good-ish IVB, good attack angle, right?
Yep.
It seems to me that he could actually be resistant to velo loss. And one thing that I saw when I recently said he was a decent buy low is that his K-BB is still good.
Right.
So he may have a fastball that is more resistant to velo loss than I expected. However, then you have this aspect that he's just a two-pitch pitcher,
yeah,
which makes his whole arsenal depend more on that fastball velocity.
Because yeah,
kind of reliever-esque as a pitcher. But next to him is Gavin Stone, who profiles much the same way with 2 inches more IVB. And I don't think maybe I give Gavin Stone enough credit because 94 is not that exciting. Maybe some of the rest of his arsenal is not that exciting, but it's a wider arsenal than Gossman's. And it looks like something that could be resistant to velo loss.
So
it's good. And like my theory here that I'm working on is if you're good in 3 out of the 4, then you can lose a little velo. Now, who do I think is I've always used as an example of fragile velo, fragile fastball. He is on the opposite end of this. He started yesterday. He's always my example. Jesus Luzardo, blue extension, dark blue extension, 5.8. You know,
it's such a bad fastball shape.
Really bad extension. 14.5 IVB is below average. Below average height adjusted vertical approach angle. So, the only thing that's red on his whole thing is 95.2. Plus, I don't know if we should we give lefties like a half tick.
Because yeah, I think so. It's weird. We see this all the time. But yeah, generally, they're just not used to it.
So, but it is the only thing that's red there. So if I was formulating theory, maybe we could use the Fantastic Four to identify fragile fastballs versus ones that are more resistant.
Now, there's one major difference, and I think you know it. You use it inside of Stuff Plus, of course, as well. That has nothing to do with the fastball itself. And it's what you pair with it. So for Gausman, having his splitter just always there makes his four seam, I think, more resilient to velocity because it's not just about the speed of that. It's about, oh no, is this the splitter or not?
He's one of the rare people that can command the splitter. So he can,
right.
He can pitch backwards if he needs to.
And the thing about Gavin Stone, which is interesting, it's absolutely an 18 IVB is, oh my gosh. But over the year, 15.7. So that's,
oh, so he's erratic.
Yeah, that was a massive shock to me yesterday that the four seamer was what it was.
Where did he pitch?
He pitched against the Mets in Citi Field.
In Citi Field.
I think it was in Citi Field.
Domes are conducive to movement usually.
Oh, interesting.
So sometimes you'll see it's actually part of why Tampa Bay leads the league in Stuff Plus every year. Not only do they have their own Stuff Plus, not only do they coach to Stuff Plus, and not only do they acquire by Stuff Plus, but their dome augments Stuff Plus.
Oh, that's wild.
Oh, that's crazy. Part of why strikeouts are up in Tampa.
Huh. That's super interesting. there's also, of course, you know, Tommy Pham saying, I couldn't see the ball.
Right. Willie Adames talks about the lighting for sure.
That was Willie Adames. That's right. Not Tommy Pham. Mm-hmm. Right. I remember that. That was so interesting. I do think that when Gavin Stone has his changeup actually as the proper nullifier, which he didn't last night, and honestly yesterday was just a lot of like, here's my fastball, this is better than usual, and here are sliders in there too. I'm like, oh cool, these
different day, different arm, here's what I got today, I
guess. Yeah, right. And it's the Mets honestly are one of those teams that like you just throw generally in the zone, like you've got a pretty good chance. Because you're a major leaguer and you have generally good enough stuff. So that worked out well for Gavin Stone yesterday. But yeah, that's the whole thing about the fragile fastball. I would include, what is this playing off of in some way, to see, like, is this more of, is this like the dominating one that's supposed to lead the way? Or is this really, like,
sink guy, like, right, maybe some aspect of number of pitches or the number of dominant pitch, otherwise dominant secondary.
The other element about Gausman is that his four-seamer, once again, is getting destroyed. It has a super high ICR, unless the super high BABIP. Remember those years of the 363 BABIP? And we're like, oh no, that's going to come down. It was like a 327 or something.
Yeah,
like
it'd be ironic, I guess, to call it a resilient two.
Because it still allows a ton of hits.
Yeah. I think that's a two-pitch thing where they are just zeroing in on, like, you could probably just, you could probably have a, if it's high, let it fly with Gausman, where you're just
The thing is, he doesn't locate high.
He knows that if he locates high, then they'll see it the fastest.
Right. So this is another interesting conversation about guys who have, like, the Blake Snell blueprint to me is about, hey, look, you throw high four seamers because those generally perform best up there. We are all about high fastballs. And especially even when you look at Gausman's, right? Gausman is a guy that actually speaks to the high four seamer, 1.3 flatness, right? A 16 vert, decent extension, right? This actually says, cool, you should be able to get whiffs upstairs. He doesn't. He actually has very little high lock. Actually, the lowest, it's first percentile in the majors this year at 28%, which is pretty much what he did last year too. And it's interesting, he actually shifted from that. It used to be like 27% low location. Now it's 40% the last 2 years. There have been theories about, you have a, if you're a two pitch guy, you got to stay low and then go underneath it. I call this the Zach Gallen method, which is also really funny. You mentioned Zach Gallen has so many pitches, but really he's just a fastball curveball guy these days. And I don't love that. I don't know.
No, I think of him as a sink guy.
Right. But the cutter and the change are there, but they're like not that great anymore. He's not consistent. And it's a lot more of just fastball curve.
Wow.
Like,
he's not like using the cutter much at all.
Yeah. It's not been there for him, for a bit. And then changeup used to be, and he's pulled away from that one too. Yeah. But but you're right. Absolutely. Like, if you are more of a kitchen sink guy, you should absolutely just show them the things. And then Gallen said back then, like, yeah, that's in their head now. Like, it doesn't mean that though they've seen it so much. It's like, if I have a couple of pitches and like I've shown them, they don't know which one's coming now. So that still keeps them on their heels. And I generally do agree with that. But if you're two pitches, you might not want to show both if you can avoid it. That makes all the sense. But back to Gausman, I do wonder, like, yeah, they just sell it for the fastball and it's in a hittable spot, right? 9 for 21 strikes yesterday for Gausman's splitter.
What did we see from bat speed? Your bat speed peaks low in the zone, like low,
right,
like low and end, basically.
Yeah. So, I mean, he's living there a ton. We're seeing an ICR that is through the roof, 53%.
Maybe what they do as a hitter is say, if it's low and in the zone, so I need to set my sights sort of belt lower. And if it's there, I'm going to swing. And some days I'm going to miss. And that's why the strikeout rate is high.
Yeah.
And some days I'm going to hit it really hard.
Right. That, I think that's the way that he's living. Thing is, the splitter swing strike rate's down. The last 3 years were 26%, 27%, 22% for Gausman's splitter. And then 2024, it's 17% now.
He generally makes me nervous every year, at the beginning of the year when we're ranking. So
I think he just allows too many hits. It's the 10 hit per nine right now. It was a 10 hit per nine in 2022. It was an 8 hit per nine last year.
I mean, he's almost like the anti-Snow.
Yeah, well, he's a prototypical, hey, I'm going to live by not allowing home runs.
Yeah.
I'm going to get singled out instead. So I'm going to have an elevated whip. His lowest whip of the last 3 years, 2022, 23, and now 24, is 118. And I think that's just a product of who he is. The strikeout rate should be better than 24%. But yeah, Kevin Gausman's kind of that guy. And the idea of him returning to like the 104 whip of 2021, I don't really think that's going to be it. I think he just gets hit too hard. Yeah. I want to jump to one last guy because I got you for like another 10 minutes. Because Eno's got production meetings or something. I don't What is that about? Then we're going to jump to this last guy from yesterday. I mean, there's, again, so many guys from yesterday. We're going to talk about one more guy after this break. Okay. Do you like Mitch Spence?
I got voted down by my co-owner in Maine to not pick him up. But I actually do like him. Okay. There's something, I mean, some of it is fantasy driven where I'm like, he's going to be at home, you know, in Oakland in a good spot. The division's, you know, full of a lot of people that won't be that great. He also is kind of a sinkish guy in that he throws sinker, cutter, slider, curve, and change. I think the cutter is good enough to be his primary fastball.
Mm-hmm.
And then in that case, the fact that the sinker profiles so poorly by Stuff Plus becomes less important,
yeah,
because he would only use the sinker against right-handers and only use it in certain situations and not use it very often. And so against left-handers, he's thrown two sinkers. So he's not ever forced into throwing the sinker, a bad sinker, to an opposite-handed guy.
Right.
And then even when he does throw the sinker, I'm going to do this real quickly, but like, I'm going to go no balls, two balls, zero strikes, five sinkers, you know, three balls, zero strikes, no sinkers. So it's a bad pitch, but it's not his primary fastball. And if you sort of refocus around the cutter as his primary fastball, you got a 91 Stuff Plus cutter, a really good slider, an average curveball, and an average change. It could work as a package.
So yesterday, Mitch Spence went against Tampa Bay Rays. So, of course, I got a text from Jason Collette. That was like, yo, this guy Mitch Spence, he's just so good. I know it's a AAA lineup, but like, this guy's so good. And I was like, all right, I'm looking forward to watching this later. The end of the game was 5.1 innings, 0 runs, 1 hit, 1 walk, 4 Ks for Mitch Spence. 39 cutters, 41 sliders, 4 sinkers, 11 curveballs, and 3 changeups. This is, to me, your version of like
sweeper.
We don't have it as a sweeper. We just have it as a slider. Watching it did feel like a sweeper. Yeah. It also could have been the raise angle a little bit, which is a little bit.
He gets like 9-10 inches. It's like borderline.
Yeah,
horizontal.
Which makes sense because both his cutter and his slider are more horizontal than they are dip.
Yeah, he's not. I mean, he's not like an IVB guy.
No, absolutely not. And we've seen this before of cutters and sliders as like what you do. I mean, there are two guys that come to mind. Obviously, there's Graham Ashcraft and then there's Drew Rasmussen. The difference is both of those guys had cutters that are more gyro cutters.
And they're harder.
And no, I was going to get to that. I was going to, you know, movement and velocity.
Yeah.
Velo is the obvious one too. But it got me thinking a little bit. Because guys just couldn't hit it. He wasn't really making a ton of mistakes in the zone with it, but he was throwing these strikes. And I see this a lot of like guys that I called the Anthony DeScofani, where like Simeon Woods Richardson yesterday just threw sliders over the zone. And I was just like, I'm not going to be the command guy today. I don't care. I'm just going to go slider, 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 slider over 50% thrown. Got away with it. 5 innings, a 2-run ball, got a win. Zach Littell has done this at times. By the way, Zach Littell looked amazing yesterday against the Oakland Athletics. Splitter was on point. Slider location was great. It was dope.
I still don't get him, dude.
Well, now I get him. That I get for against the Athletics. That was good. Mm. But right, most of the time it's Anthony DeScofani. I'm just like sliders all over the place. Who cares? And that's that. So you have that still here with Mitch Spence, but then you pair that with a cutter that is still hard to hit. Mm-hmm. Right. And why I bring up Rasmussen and Morse and Ashcraft is not because of the velocity necessarily. It's because that's how they thrive too. Before Rasmussen really became that strikeout guy, he was the absurd, like 5 innings, 1 strikeout, 1 hit guy, you know, and cutter slider guys are kind of good, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, with Ashcraft, it's just like, where's the ball going though? Like, let's be honest, where's it going?
And he's even more of a two pitch guy than
Rasmussen was. Yeah.
No, I mean Ashcraft.
Yeah, Ashcraft is more of a two pitch guy than
Spence.
Then Spence. Oh yeah, sure. I mean, times we do see the sinker become like a thing for a start or so for Ashcraft. But yeah, right. There is a curveball that's 13% usage right now for Spence. But is this kind of like the new thing that of like just guys out of nowhere? You know what? If you have a good cutter and a good slider, it kind of works to both batters. And the Yankees were hinting at it a little bit, but is it the debate between is that a slider or a sweeper? I prefer it not being a sweeper because you can then throw it more to both sides.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a really good slider and a really terrible fastball, all I think is like find a way to make that fastball a cutter.
Right. Yeah. I think a key for Spence is keeping that slider velo over 84.
Yeah, sure. I mean, he's right at that right now. Last night was 83.5.
Yeah.
But I guess what I'm getting at is like, sure, you're not going to overwhelm as much as others. Because,
does he remind you of Spencer Turnbull at all?
Because
Spencer Turnbull's fastball is a cutter now.
Yeah, I totally get that.
And then
that really is a cutter.
Cutter, yeah. Sweeper. His changeup, Turnbull's changeup is better, I guess.
There's more of a sink, I think, with Turnbull.
But this has become a package. And right. I did just talk to Turnbull a lot last night. And good God, the Tigers situation was terrible. I mean.
Oh, man.
He had like a broken bone in his neck.
What?
Yeah. It's crazy. He had like he got a whiplash injury by being hit in a second start of the year, and it pulled a bone off his neck. Like the ligament pulled. I've had this before. You can have a ligament can pull a fracture off of the bone. Yeah. Cause the ligament can be stronger than the bone.
Right.
And so it pulled. So he had a strained neck that had pulled a bone loose. And he was pitching in pain all year, and the Tigers doctors just like thought he was whining.
Oh my God.
And then do you remember that transaction that came through the wire that was like Turnbull was about to get optioned?
Yeah.
And then he said, no, my neck hurts, and he got put on the IL instead.
Right. And then
my read on that has always been like, oh, that was a phantom IL.
Yeah, right.
But I think it was much more complicated than that.
Oh my gosh.
He also said that he is a supinator.
Yeah, right. He gets so that's, guys, if you don't know the difference, pronating, supinating, pronating is essentially you're turning over on a changeup. Supinating means you can come around on like a slider cutter more.
Yeah, a pronator pulls down towards his thumb, and a supinator is holding a little bit more towards his pinky.
Right.
The person Turnbull knew the most about, and we were looking at grips on my phone, is Sonny Gray.
Well, I was about to say Sonny Gray is like the best version of this.
So he has Sonny Gray's Sonny Gray's sweeper grip.
Yeah. Oh man, Sonny Gray essentially has four seamers like a cutter, and he also has two breaking balls, a curve and sweeper. And
but the thing that was interesting was I was telling him Turnbull this idea, this sort of Spence, Wesnensky, Clark Schmidt, Michael King, like this idea that like if you have a certain slot, like you should be cutter, sinker, sweeper.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And the one thing that Turnbull pushed back on me and was like, yes, but not everybody with my slot is a supinator.
Mm.
So that's that extra. And I think that's the extra thing that is different. So Michael King has a pretty good changeup. So he's not a full supinator. He can pronate. You know, he has a decent changeup. Wesnensky never had, I don't think, a good changeup. Mm-hmm. Clark Schmidt's changeup has never been good. But Clark Schmidt, I think, is probably a supinator. And so he's really focused on the cutter, and he's doing the best he's ever done by being more cutter curve against lefties. And the cutter is the best it's ever been. And the command is great. In his last start, Clark Schmidt got six strikeouts against lefties.
The cutter is insane. It's been like three starts now watching this. Yeah. And I've been banging the drum being like, once Clark Schmidt figures out his cutter, he's got it because he has all the tools against right-handers. It's just about figuring out lefties. And
so we need to teach Brandon Pfaadt a cutter.
Oh my gosh.
Because he can't get lefties out. And is Brandon Pfaadt one of these guys?
Sweeper, I mean, okay. So his four seamer did get seven whiffs finally last night, but yeah, he's just a sweeper guy.
He's a sweeper sinker guy. I mean, yeah. He took off when they taught him
sweeper, the sinker. Super four seamer for Pfaadt.
I know, but they taught him the sinker and that's what he went on the.
Oh, right. He just added this. Yeah.
Yeah. He went on the postseason run with the sinker.
Right.
But he has troubles against lefties.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, sinker is not the answer.
And it is a sweeper.
Right. Oh man. So yeah, really Mitch Spence to me is this, that was a lovely, lovely transition into bring this back here, that Mitch Spence is part of this little interesting mold that I think we're going to start seeing, what do you know, the year of the cutter next year, guys.
Not the year of the splitter?
Never. Who actually is like got the splitter and it's working, say, for Cal Quantrill?
Yeah, Cal Quantrill.
He's the only one, right? Yeah. Right?
We should dig into
it. It's like a new splitter that's like changing everything.
Of the splitter.
Is it? It's
I
just
could start a flame war with Mike Petriello. Mike Petriello was wrong. It is not the year of the splitter. I love Mike.
I mean, I really can't think of anyone that's new of it. I mean, sure, we have like Imanaga come over. Sure, we have Yamamoto come over, but like they already had them.
Right.
Who like Wait, really I think adopted
there's an
more.
Easy way to do this?
Bryce Miller, but
hold on.
Hunter Greens isn't whatever. You have Tyler McGill's not really coming through. It's just Cal Quantrill just upped his usage.
On Fangraphs, they have this thing, year-to-year changes, pitching. So you go to, on Fangraphs, it's the splits leaderboard, and you can do year-to-year changes. So minimum, how many innings pitch you want this year?
Let's just go with 15.
15, all right. So we're doing 15. We're doing pitch type, and it's FS. Okay, we've got the list, the full list. It's really short. Dean Kramer.
Oh, sure. He had moments with it.
Zach Wheeler.
Yeah, he's always had a splitter in the mix.
But he's up 10%.
Oh,
George Kirby, obviously.
Yeah.
We should remember him. And Chris Bassett.
Ha! He wasn't already throwing one?
I think he was already throwing one. He's just up 2%.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
That's
the Kirby one is the one that really started, I think, the whole thoughts about it. But honestly, that has not been doing much for him.
In fact, he's kind of stepped off the gas on a little bit.
Right. So, all right. That's a good note to end on here. I'm not going to make Eno late. Last thing here, of course, what are you working on this week?
Mike Petriello was wrong.
What do you got this week, Eno?
I've got a good thing coming up tomorrow. It's just my notes column, but there's an ode to the front door sinker, a little snippet of conversation with me, Christopher Sanchez, and then a duo of Alex Cobb and Logan Webb playing off each other and making fun of each other. I hope I nailed the execution of it because I was laughing my ass off.
Oh, that's great.
And it all starts with who do you think of when you think of front door sinker in the history of baseball?
I mean, for you, it was Corey Kluber. For me, it's Bartolo Colon.
You were right. It's Colon. I mean, I mentioned Kluber and they were like, yeah, but they said Colon.
That's Colon.
So I was like, okay.
Colon was right. Yeah.
Plus, I found video of Colon striking out Jose Ramirez, not Barry Bonds, on a front door sinker at 84 and a half.
Yeah, it's insane.
When Colon is like,
42.
Yeah.
You got to get out of here. Go. Okay, I'm not going to make you late, okay? Thank you all so much for listening to another episode of The Craft. We'll be back next week to talk more about the craft of pitching.